Hello, and welcome to Hard Fried History, a hybrid history
and comedy
podcast run by two aspiring entertainers.
Podcast, it's more of a rant, really.
That have failed at almost everything else.
I don't fail because I don't try, so there.
We appreciate you checking us out, and if you want to see extra content, follow us on Instagram or give us a like on Facebook at Hard Fried History.
Subscribe to us on YouTube or tell us we're full of shit on Twitter at HFH Podcast.
Feel like going that extra mile? Give us a 5-star rating on iTunes. Or wherever you're listening, and leave us a flattering, a glowing review.
And of course, tell your friends, family, and even people you don't like about us.
That's right. Again, thank you for listening, and without further ado, the episode.
Guys, welcome back to another episode of Hard Fried History. Today, guys, we're going to be talking about the Attica prison uprising, prison rebellion. Some people are going to call it a prison riot. Really just depends on which side of the fence we're going to talk.
Prison insurgency.
Didn't that apply long lasting, like an insurgency?
I think it, yeah, generally speaking, it's got to be a longer period of time.
We're just going to talk. Okay, we're going to talk about the event. I mean, you can talk about prison rights or, you know, prison reform or whatever, or prison abolition as an insurgency. Mm-hmm. But today we're going to talk about the event, the uprising, rebellion, riot, whatever you want to call it, that happened in 1971 in upstate New York at the Attica Maximum Correctional Facility. So the book I read was going to be Heather Ann Thompson's Blood in the Water. It's a really good book for if you want a play-by-play of the incidents. Also, all of the court cases, the Attica brothers' legal defense that happens for up until like I think it's the 80s or the 90s, and then the Forgotten Victims of Attica, that group, and then their lobbying efforts. Pretty much everything Attica. This is going to be pretty good on. It has been criticized for not really talking about the prisoners, more, you know, prison abolitionist views. Mm. It has been criticized for not talking more about the politics of the prisoners, which could be called Maoist, or I think would be defined as Maoist by some. You know, I'm not going to speak for the whole group. And it relies heavily on state evidence, because that's really all the evidence we have. You know what I mean? But yeah. It was some talk on the article that read, you could have done it a little bit better. But this is a Pulitzer Prize book, Pulitzer Prize winning book. And without further ado, we're going to get into the background of Attica and all the stuff leading up to Attica and the actual event and some of the aftershocks. So to understand, Attica happens in 1971, but you have to understand what's going on before 1971 to truly understand Attica. You need to go back to the mid-60s, specifically after the Watts riot. And we have to talk about LBJ and his Law Enforcement Assistant Act that, you know, Johnson passed in March 8th, I think it was 65. It was like the first like direct role for the federal government to like fund like local police and like court systems and like state prisons. And this is all a reaction, of course, to the the riots happened in 65 and in 68, but then also this is a reaction to like the kind of the law and order part of it.
Yeah.
Like, why do you need order if you have the law?
Yeah.
What's the order part of it? I think we've talked about it
previously
in different episodes. We talk about the FBI's role, and they see law and order as maintaining a structure, a cultural order or a structure, you know, a structure within society.
Yeah, FBI kind of sees order as just crush all dissent. Don't tolerate any form of dissent, not violent, nonviolent. It starts nonviolent, becomes violent, and then it's like, ah, we have a pretext now.
Yeah. So with these laws are being passed, there's some like mass like crime spree, like crime just shooting through the roof. But actually, if you look at the numbers, like around 1968, the crime is much lower than it was in the early 60s, and much lower than it was in like the 50s. It's kind of a weird thing when people even talk about crime, like recently, and they're like, yeah, man, if the crime's out of control. Like I remember 2014, people would be like, it was 2014 or sometime around there, where people were like, you know, crime's out of control. Yeah. And then like if you looked at like a kid in California, he had the same violence rate as a kid from like the 1950s. Like, I think we don't compare those two because we're like, I think there's people talk about crime, but the numbers actually tell like a much different
story. Yeah, I think what we're getting into is a sort of over-reliance on personal experience and anecdotal evidence. Or nobody's going to look at the statistics, but people see everyone in the nation for the most part, whenever a school shooting happens, you get that notification and that's all the headline. That's all people are talking about. So there's the perception that crime is increasing when in fact,
these like crazy low crime levels.
Comparatively, so I don't know the statistics, but that's what I've heard is that crime is actually going down in America. World's actually becoming, I don't know if you can say a safer place. People are getting along, I don't even want to say better, less violently. I don't know, man.
It's that lead in the paint, dude. It's that lead in that paint, dude.
Yeah.
Never that stopped.
Yeah. All of a sudden people came. Reliance on more subtle forms of aggression and that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
Is this progress? Yeah. I don't know.
I don't know. You can call it that. So kind of getting back to the what's going on in the 60s. These crime laws, these crime bills, this kind of intense focus on law and order, of course, with starting with the LBJ and his Law Enforcement Assistance Act, and then moving through to Nixon, who gets elected, I think at 68, on a law and order like mandate.
My man.
Right?
People My man, are Nixon.
You had a weird face when you were in the Nixon, and I was not a party to it. people are they're throwing a lot of people in prison, and they're cracking down or whatever, and they're throwing all these people in prison, so it's overcrowding these prisons. And one of these prisons, specifically one of these prisons, is Attica, which is kind of in upstate New York, where there are a lot of prisons. Attica, Green Haven, Auburn, Clinton Correctional Facility, all these like weird upstate New York towns where like there isn't shit. Then their main industry is prisons and locking, kind of correctional facilities.
And a local sign manufacturer who gets 43% of their business making "do not pick up hitchhiker" signs.
That's you don't think the state has exported that to the Chinese manufacturer?
I hope not. Come
there's
on,
no
man.
There's no that's, such thing as small business that's in America anymore.
Hey man, you speak for yourself. All right, I run a small business. Okay,
I'm gonna take you out.
You're gonna take us out.
I can't wait till you guys start shipping all your stuff from China and just like we're American.
We got some stuff, not everything. Yeah. Some stuff, but not everything. Anyway.
So, this specifically when you focus on Attica at this time, it's suffering from that overcrowding, and it's a prison that was built in the 30s.
It's a sweaty time.
It's also a cold time because you're in upstate New York.
Okay.
So, in the years leading up to the riot, one former prisoner, Joseph Jazz Hayden, said Attica was a stark place. You had only an hour a day of recreation, and the rest of the time, it was like something out of the 1870s. Poor medical care, overcrowding, forced hard labor, brutality from guards, and deplorable living conditions. Like, you were basically, your cell was the size of a bathroom.
Jesus.
And people remember, like, people would go out in the wintertime. They would stand in the sleet, in the snow, just to have, like, time outside. Like, it's fucked. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's, like, it's a very rough, fucked up environment. Also, the guards are, like, known for, like, they didn't, like, do talking. They just hit you with the baton.
Yeah.
Like, that's all. They were known for beating you, and if they would beat you. And then they would place you in keep lock, which is just kept you locked up, which is what it sounds like. And then, or they could throw you in HPZ, which I'm pretty sure is segregation.
There's there's when in Angela Davis's autobiography, yeah, she mentioned, because she was also imprisoned in New York, and so maybe this is true for the entire state, but she mm-hmm. said that a prison guard is one of the top paying jobs that you could get without a college degree. And then I've read some other shit about like nasty prisoners at like, I think it's Lompoc. I'm not sure where that is exactly, but there were like people being interviewed about like the AIM movement and everything. And yeah, people were saying like, yeah, I would trust my wife next to one of the inmates over the guards at Lompoc, because they're just nasty motherfuckers.
Yeah, so that's like this is like rural upstate New York. So this is, yeah, of course, this is like the best, like one of the best jobs these people can get.
Yeah.
It is still a fucking super low paying job.
You have your two options: to be a prison warden or to work at the sign factory. Okay, that's it.
Yeah, that's all you got. That's
and jobs are drying up there because they're outsourcing to China. So what are you going to do, you know?
Exactly. You really get in upstate New York in 1971.
I'm nailing it, man. I'm here, all right?
So in this like environment, it's overcrowded, it's fucked up, and everybody knows it's fucked up. The prisoners are complaining that it's fucked up, and then the guards are also complaining. Like there's various conversations between the union reps and like the kind of higher ups in the prison like system, who are just like, the union reps are like, you're sitting on powder keg, because there's not enough guards to fucking do what you. This harsh ass prison environment you want to have, there's not enough guards for it, and all the guards are starting to feel unsafe, and they're complaining, and there's kind of like a union prison like a CO kind of like backlash, where they're just like we really need to do something about this. So, and also in this environment, of course, it is the late 60s, early 70s. So at a place where you had the Black Panther Party like blossoming. You had a place, also a place where the NOI was was recruiting heavily. Like the NOI is doing a lot of like prison work during the 60s and stuff.
What
like that.
What is the NOI?
Nation of Islam.
Oh, okay.
Of Islam. Sorry, yeah. And then the smaller numbers, you would have these 60s radicals just in there. Like you had like, I think it's Sam Melville, who's called the Mad Bomber, who's like part of the Weather Underground, if I'm speaking on that correct. So you have like these people in here, like all these kind of radicals are kind of, you know, radicals, activists. I think I would deem more they'd be activists.
Yeah.
Kind of in this prison population, kind of circling around, they're doing like prison education lectures on like the yard and stuff, and it's a place where like kind of like activism and your idea of like your the people's like sense of themselves is blossoming.
Mm-hmm.
And collective organization is a thing that's like people are talking about, because that's what's being talked about on the outside.
Yeah.
Right. So kind of just what's happening also around in the prison system, just in New York in general. And in 1970, you have the Toombs Rebellion, which is, you know, you watch Law and Order SVU.
Hell yeah. Hell yeah.
The like, well, we'll send them to the Toombs. So there was a rebellion in the Toombs in 1970 where prisoners like just kind of rioted, rebelled, they had an uprising, and that was settled peacefully. And then some of those prisoners got shipped up to Attica. Mm-hmm. Then there is the November 4th, 1970, inmates at Auburn prison, also in upstate New York, seized control of the facility and held about 50 people, including guards and construction workers, hostage for more than 8 hours. And this was, I think the NOI was heavily involved in that, from my understanding of what I read. And they were in like, that ended peacefully. But then some of those guys got shipped from Auburn to segregation at Attica. So it's kind of like this coalescing, and like, weirdly, maybe, I don't know if they sent everybody there,
mm-hmm.
but they sent like enough people, specifically from the Auburn prison uprising, to Attica, and they had them in segregation until they released them.
Is this primarily like the leadership?
This is so. Yeah, they tried to do the people who led the rebellion. They were like, okay, yeah.
You see, one thing I've learned from studying all this history that we've been doing for a year and a half, going on 2 years now, is that whenever you are trying to prevent a mass mm-hmm. uprising, the yeah. best thing for you to do is to centralize yeah. the leadership of the opposition. You yeah. take no, all a- of your you take all of your public enemy number ones and you put them together and you just let them brainstorm.
Yeah, but then again, like, this stuff wouldn't take off if it wasn't the same conditions. Like, the same thing that they're complaining about at Auburn, the same thing they complain about in the Tombs, is the same thing they complain about at Attica. And it's the same place, same thing they complain about at Greenhaven. Same thing, like, it's just around and around. Everybody has the same issue. So in the
Tombs in Auburn, they get their complaints resolved for the most part? Like, conditions improve? Or did they just make the promise to improve the conditions and then just keep on serving fucking mush?
Yeah, they make the promise.
Okay.
And then
they
just kind of mess them. Like, at Auburn, they were like, hey, which is like where Jomo Joko Amawale, who's like going to have a part in this, in the Attica uprising, he's part of the Auburn Six, as they're called, the leaders that were then sent to Attica. He was like, they had agreed to be like, hey, no reprisals, no guard reprisals after this. Mm-hmm. No, none of that. And then they, right after reprisals, like, damn, right after.
Okay, right on.
So in the summer of 1971, a small group called the Attica Liberation Faction, which is prisoners, put together a list of demands for something called the July Manifesto, and they sent it to the state prison chief, Russell Oswald. Russell Oswald is like the state, like the kind of the head of like corrections in New York. He just came from California, so he had experienced all kind of like the George Jackson, Angela Davis yeah. stuff going on over there. The superintendent is a guy named Vincent Mancusi, and he just is a police. He's a warden. Everything about him, just Vincent Mancusi. Yeah, that dude's gonna try to keep you locked away for life.
Vincent Mancusi. One thing I know about Vincent Mancusi, he gets hella kickbacks.
Yeah,
he gets a lot of kickbacks.
I love. And then the governor at the time is going to be Nelson Rockefeller, who will later become the vice president. I think under Ford, if I'm pretty sure. So they send their complaints, like this. The Attica Liberation Faction sends their complaints to their complaints, which is in the July Manifesto, to Oswald. They converse with Oswald. They go back and forth. He's not responsive, but he is responsive. Like, he appreciates them being like formal and nice. Mm-hmm. And he's like, he kind of agrees that he's going to talk to them. Like, in the summer of 1971, if I'm correct. And he like goes to the prison, and like everybody's like, he's going to deliver a message. And then they hear, oh, the message is going to be delivered over the PA. Over like the, you know, the public announcement system. And then they were like, oh, that's kind of weird. And then he was supposed to respond to their want.
I see.
And then he just kind of like bloviates over the PA, doesn't really give them anything concrete. And like, they're like, I don't know what he thought they were, but they were like already, they were like so like, they were like very upset by the prison conditions. And they were at the breaking point already. The Oswald guy is like, he's like seen as more of like a reformer, like the reluctant guy. Like, he actually kind of would like to reform, but like he's not putting his neck out there for it.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Yeah. So that like angers them a lot more. Like, they've tried the peaceful way. They tried to like ask, they corresponded with the state corrections top official. And that guy kind of blew them the fuck off. So now they're at this, they're at another point. They're farther, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you get into September 8th of 1971. You have the Dewar incident, which is this 23-year-old kid who was like fresh off like key block. He had been in the cell for a long time. So he's just like out in the yard, like roughhousing, having a good time. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, mm-hmm. just play fighting with somebody. And then it's like this guard, the CO comes over, Lieutenant Maroney. And he just basically like, he's like, hey, you gotta go back inside. And Dewar's like, he's like 20. He's like, why? He's like, why the fuck I have to go back inside? Like, I've been in, kind of fuck you. And basically he turns his back on Lieutenant. Lieutenant turns around. Dewar hits him in the chest. And like, everybody was just like, what the fuck? Nobody did anything. Everybody was like, oh, this is this is interesting. Mm-hmm. And then there's this weird incident where like everybody's standing around watching Dewar be chased by this Lieutenant Maroney, who's like a older white guy. I'm pretty sure.
While Benny Hill plays.
Yeah,
and he's he has to pull up his pants a lot.
Yeah.
Maroney does because he didn't get a belt that morning, so he's running around shaking the baton.
Feels like, but everybody's like, what the fuck is, like they're all like, it's kind of silent because they're just like, what the fuck? Because so that happens. Another one of the, I think it's Lieutenant Curtis, is like, hey, just fall back and like let it. So he kind of pulls Lieutenant Maroney out of that situation. The Dewar and Lamori also is another prisoner that was either comes in and was calling Lieutenant Maroney names or also hitting Maroney. It's, you know, people disagree on that part. So everybody kind of goes their separate ways. Dewar and Lamori go into their cells for the night. And then later that night, guards go into Lamori's cell, and then they go in Dewar's cell, and there's like a struggle in Dewar's cell, and there's some commotion, and then they pull him out of there, and he's like limp, like So everybody's like, oh, that guy's fucking dead. They killed him. They fucking killed Dewar. They killed this 23-year-old kid. So they're already incredibly upset, right? Not only they're in prison, they're in these awful conditions. It fucking sucks in here. We've tried to ask people for like just the bare minimum medical. Like they only could take a shower once a week.
Damn.
they only could see a doctor, and the doctor like didn't give a fuck about them and told them like would just blow them off. Like, so it's kind of building. It's building, and so on September 9th, 1971, Five Company, which is like, they have kind of defined it by like five companies and you know, there's different cell blocks. Most of the stuff is going to happen in cell block D. So on Thursday, September 9th, 1971, Five Company lined up for roll call, and hearing rumors that one of their compatriots, that Dewar, had been like fucked up and assaulted, this guy named William Ortiz hits an officer with like a soup can. And then they throw him back in his cell. And then the rest of the company, continues to breakfast. And then the part of the company breaks off and goes and frees Ortiz, like, from his cell. They then rejoin the rest of the company to go to breakfast. A short time later, the command staff discovered what had occurred. They changed the usual scheduling of prisoners. Because everything's on a schedule. When they're walking you to place, like, the gate's supposed to open. And if it doesn't fucking open, then, like, that's when shit gets sticky. Because you constantly want these prisoners in that prison mind state. You want them moving and constantly in motion to get to their places. So they didn't tell people, hey, we're changing how we're doing this, and some of these gates are going to be locked. So they didn't tell Officer Gordon Kelsey that they had changed the schedule. So instead of going to the yard after breakfast that they usually did, the prisoners were led to find a locked door. And it just like puzzled them, and they're like, all right, what the fuck is going on? And then like they were complaining because they're like, oh, they're not going to let us out. They're not going to let us out for like the sweet, precious time that we do get. So Kelsey's like trying to like calm them down, and then the complaints led to anger. Kelsey was assaulted by the group that he was with, and then that's how the riot begins.
So they're going on their way back to their cells, thinking that they're like not being let outside because they're expecting to be let outside.
There's multiple groups going on. Like there's a group that is with the Kelsey guy, with the Kelsey CO, that he like they're like kind of pressed up against his door, and then like all of a sudden he's like, they complaints lead to anger. He's the only one around, and then he gets assaulted, right?
Okay.
And then that's when the riot begins.
But they're like out and about on the floor, or just this company is.
Yeah, just this company. Okay. It's like they're like pressed up against like this place. It's going to be called like Times Square. I'm pretty sure. I might be getting some of the dynamics of this wrong because they're describing a fucking prison. I've never been to. But they're at this door. They can't get out. And then he's the only one right there because, of course, they're short staffed. And then they fuck him up. And then the inmates like started quickly, like the kind of war gets out as a riot. The inmates started quickly gaining control of sections, right? of D Yard, two tunnels, and then the gang controlled this place called called Times Square, which is like the place that's kind of like the pendulum where you can go a lot of different places. Mm-hmm. And in the process of like gaining control of Times Square, they seriously injure this guy named William Quinn, he's like relatively young CEO. So within a couple of hours, it's like 1,200 of like the 2,200 inmates had already taken like 42 officers hostage, officers and civilians hostage. There was like an accountant who got caught up in all this shit. And, you know, so like the first hours like were chaos, like absolute chaos. But soon it like kind of, out of chaos came structure, because you have those more organized parts of the prison, like those more organized groups start to kind of like seize control, and they kind of start to organize everything in D-Yard. In the first like there's like rapes that happen in the first like couple of hours. It's a shit show. But after a while, everybody kind of gets organized. You have like this guy named Frank Big Black Smith. He was appointed like the head of security because he was massive, and they were like specifically like trying to keep the hostages safe. And they were trying to, because they knew that was like, that's their card. Like, hey, if these hostages get really hurt, it's gonna like there's no go. It's these are our guys to get our complaints heard and responded to.
I see.
So like they're in this D yard. Everybody's kind of just enjoying being outside, like, because they're never outside. And they're getting organized there. At this time, this is also when the New York State Police arrives on the scene. And these are going to be your New York State troopers. And they arrive on the scene. And I marked that they're here at this early because we're going to go through a couple of days. And it's good. We're going to talk about the effect of them being just outside this prison for that many days. So the state, like, as far as like Nelson Rockefeller and like Oswald, they both think it's like the beginning of a communist, the vanguard of a communist assault, because one, they're fucking, it's the early 70s and mm-hmm. they are these guys. Two, you got Oswald was involved in like all of the California prison stuff. And he like, they're specifically like memos where they're talking about Angela Davis, who has nothing to do with this fucking, nothing to do with this shit. And so they're seeing like, oh, they're just connecting dots. They're Glenn Becking it.
They're like Glenn Becking it. They got their yarn. Yeah. They got their thumbtacks and they are spinning a narrative. All right.
Yeah. They're like, this is the beginning of the full black uprising.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, you know what I mean? That's what they're doing in their mind. So September 9th, kind of, it's the first day of the riot, the first day of the uprising. Then September 10th, 1971, is the next day. The prisoners ask for like observers to come and like be a part and aid in the negotiations. So like, there were these guys. It's got Tom Wicker, who's an editor from the New York Times. Nice. James Ingram, who's he's from the Michigan Chronicles. I'm pretty sure it's an African American newspaper. You have a senator like John Dunn, state representative Arthur Eve, and then you have like civil rights lawyer William Kunstler, who you know from the Chicago 7 trial. And then you'll have they like requested like a bunch of people. They requested that Louis Farrakhan come, but he decided not to come. They requested Bobby Seale come. Bobby Seale will make an appearance here. There was also like one guy who was just this guy named Jabbar Kenyatta, who everybody was just like, who is this guy, and how the fuck did he get?
you don't know Jabbar, man. Come on.
Yeah,
you don't know Jabbar. Come on.
He's just over here, just like, like everybody's like the kind of when they talk about it, they kind of talk about him like he's a nuisance. So these observers get here. And they're talking to like Russell Oswald, you know, the head of prisons in New York, and they're like, all right, what do you want us to do? And Russell Oswald's just like, you're gonna negotiate. You're basically gonna go back and forth between the two.
Okay, like, I mean, Oswald makes sense. Like they're the inmates are playing it smart at this point. Like you definitely want more eyes on the scene. You want media more than that. You want people who are gonna be in there blowing up the story. Like, oh, hey, this is occurring here and this is what they're upset about. That way you can move towards more public pressure.
that's what the book
kind like, of let's just bust about. This open, you know?
Yeah, they talked about in the book, like, this being, like, one the first prison riot, rebellion, uprising that was, like, TV, like, TV ready. Like, it was nightly news. You know what I mean?
you turned off Vietnam. You turned on Attica riots, all right? That was it.
Yeah. So...
And you drank Miller. You
it was letting everything during these years. So September 11th, 1971, this is 2 days into the uprising. They're kind of going back and forth, and they're just like the prisoners present a manifesto with its 28 demands. You know, they present it to the New York State officials. It's called the Attica Liberation Faction Manifesto of Demands.
ALFMOD.
Okay, that's I don't think Alf they would mod. Call it that.
28 demand ALFMOD.
And they it's basically like better medical treatment, fair visitation rights, and the physical brutality. They also wanted better sanitation, improved food quality, rules of, you know, they would once they wanted they had like numerous demands about like like just kind of getting better prison, like a better prison living situation. But then they had like a couple of things that like they just kind of, I feel like they threw it out there because they kind of let go of the shit real quick.
Yeah.
Like they had one where they're like, we want to be exported or expedited to a non-colonialist nation, and they were like, nah, you're not.
I feel like there was I think this was there was just one or two guys. Probably one guy, one nerd who's really into the doctrine, you know, really into the shit and is like, no, I really cannot put my name to this, to ALFMOD, if we do not include the specific passage about being exported to a nation that isn't run by a fascist, tyrannical, neo-imperialist government, man. I will not sign ALFMOD if we do not include this.
They threw like, right, it out.
Whatever, man. It's easier not to argue with this guy at this point.
I mean, honestly, what happened? They threw it out there, and like, it was like part of their original package of demands. And then like, they like the Kunstler, William Kunstler, who's like more of like a activist lawyer, who's like kind of like being like, yeah, you can still like, and everybody's like, all right. All the rest of the representatives are like, y'all need to let that go. That was like, and then they do like a vote on it after like. They saw the state was like, no, that's a no-go.
Yeah.
It was like one or two people like were like, oh, we're not going to get that.
We're not going to get it. All right, damn. Well, you
know.
You got to shoot the shot, man. You got to shoot the shot.
Of course, you know, I can't describe like how the prisoners felt fully because it's a mixed bag of things, right? It's going to be a majority black place, like 85% black, of who's actually doing the rebellion, the uprising. There are going to be prison abolitionist people like, you know, especially later in their once they kind of in their activist careers, you know, with the Attica Brothers legal defense, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Definitely. So I don't want to whitewash or not talk about that. This story is also a story that has a lot to do with prison abolitionists, I think. I'm pretty sure. The manifesto also assigned like the power to negotiate the five inmates, Donald Noble, Peter Butler, Frank Lott, Carl Jones L, Herbert Blyden X. And additionally, the document specifically lists out the vile and vicious slave masters who oppressed the prisoners, such as the New York governor, New York corrections, and the United States courts, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's not nice is not the right word. It's not whitewashed shit. Like, this is revolutionary shit. They're trying to, like, they have revolutionary politics, and they are enacting those revolutionary politics through, like, a collective uprising.
Mm-hmm.
Again, Russell Oswald accepts most of the demands, but the settlement is, like, basically, like, stuck on this, on the demand of amnesty, that, you know, these prisoners, for their like actions within the riots, will get amnesty. And on September, the thing that complicates that further, and that fucks this whole thing up, is that guard William Quinn, the original that guy who was hurt in Times Square, so severely injured.
In the first day,
he dies of his injuries. on September 11th. So now they're at this point where, like, the state can't give amnesty because there's a dead CO on the dead state
officials. But they could to the officers who killed Dewar.
No, well, Dewar's really still alive. Dewar's still alive. Yeah, right, Dewar ends up being alive. But they can't. There's gonna be some amnesty later. Don't worry about that. So they can't give amnesty. They're not gonna give you amnesty because there's a dead guy here. And then, but the prisoners are like, oh, now we need amnesty because there's just been the guard has been killed here. Mm-hmm. So we need amnesty and protection against reprisals. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So September 12th, 1971, right? We're getting to this is at the point where they're asked, everybody's like, if the governor comes here, he can sell this shit. Before I think Bobby Seale came and Bobby Seale came and was like, he looked at the list of demands. It was like, yeah, everything y'all are giving them, they need amnesty also. That's what the main point is. If they don't get amnesty, I'm not going to tell them, you should fucking sign this because the reprisals and what will happen after.
Yeah, won't mean anything if there's no amnesty.
Yeah, so September 12th, 1971, Nelson Rockefeller, he refuses to visit Attica. So he just kind of closes the door on that. After being asked by the hostages, prisoner representatives, civilian observers, everybody asked him. The Commissioner Oswald asked him, the state prison official, everybody asked him. He refused. I think because he didn't want to be anywhere around it. I think because they were on this law and order kick. Like Rockefeller was getting on this law and order kick where it's like, we got to be as hard as possible. And I think at a certain point, they just resolved that they were just going to retake it by force. And on the 12th is when the Rockefeller and the state officials decide, hey, we're gonna retake this prison by force, and we're not gonna we're gonna go in there with weapons. I brought up the New York State Police to at the beginning to say that now it's been 3 days, and the New York State Police is still sitting outside. It's a collection of the New York State Police, the COs that weren't taken hostage, county sheriffs from all these random fucking upstate New York counties, and their deputies are stewing. And all the rumors that they're hearing on the outside is that the prisoners are castrating guards. Mm. So you already got their racial hatred that they already have. That's
crazy. Yeah.
Yeah, right? They already don't like black people. Yeah. And then also these black people are prisoners. So they have an added layer of inmate, of disdain for them. And then on top of all that, now they're getting these rumors that these people are mistreating who they prisoners. Think are, it's like their brother in arms.
Yeah.
So
meanwhile, there is a string of McDonald's up in upstate New York that is seeing the best business that it has ever seen before. They are slammed.
Oh, some of these guys. They do not
know how to handle it. And there is a sweaty manager, bedecked with acne, who is just freaking out because he does not have to service all these pigs.
Some of these guys in this blood in the water book, you look at these photos, you look at these guys, they look like they invented coffee and fucking donuts. They look
there was no
stars.
Coffee and donuts. Yeah, man.
So, and at this time, the New York State Police is also being given just 270 rifles, kind of deer hunting rifles. And they're not recording which rifle belongs to who.
Wait, who's giving them to them?
The police are handing the actual New York State Police on the ground, new 270, these are deer hunting rifles. And they're not recording who's getting who. Who's getting which one or what number, serial numbers.
Wait, the police is handing the New York, which police is handing the New York State
Police? The New York State Police is handing, out within themselves rifles.
Okay.
With serial numbers, of course they have serial numbers on them. But they're not saying who has those serial numbers. They're not tracking who has which gun. So as they're about to do this retaking, they're going in just with a lot of miscellaneous guns, and they don't know who's firing these guns. So on September 13th, the Commissioner Oswald gives the inmates a statement directing prisoners within the hour to release hostages and accept the settlement proposal that they had offered. The inmates declined to release the hostages or to surrender. I think they kind of knew it was coming, but they didn't know what was coming, which is fucked up. They I think at a certain point they take like some of the hostages onto like these catwalks that are above the yard, right? Uh-huh. And they kind of have they have these hostages with like knives to the hostages, like kind of like throats or heads or stuff like that, because they want to show like, hey, we have the hostages, they're all right. They're like, well, we'll hurt them, but like even like between the hostages and like the prisoners, they're like telling them, we're not gonna hurt you. This is all kind of for show. Yeah. Like, you
who
know what I mean?
The hostages primarily, are they like prison bureaucrats, or is it also like some families on visitation?
It's all it's COs, and I think it's a lot of COs, and I think there's one accountant. There's one, okay. Accountant. So tear gas is dropped from like helicopters, and it just basically neutralizes everybody, because it's like strong ass tear gas. It's like shit that other people like don't use anymore. It's like the most the fucked up shit, and like everybody's kind of incapacitated, and that's when the fucking New York State Police, again, New York State Police, COs, county, and like random sheriffs and sheriff deputies from like adjoining counties come in, and they run in there and they spray nearly indiscriminately like a barrage of like 200 rounds of it's fired. And they have a lot of like shotguns.
2,000 rounds?
2,000. Sorry, my apologies. 2,000 rounds. They spray like 2,000 rounds just around, just indiscriminately. Now, and this is with the fact that nobody in the prison has a gun. There's no guns.
Yeah, that's fucking crazy.
There's no guns in the prison. And they know there's no guns in the prison. So they're just shooting randomly, and they're shooting and killing hostages. They're shooting, and one hostage, they got shot like four times, just straight. Like, they're shooting and killing every fucking body.
This is the rootin' tootinist shit that could have occurred. This is like lunacy.
Yeah. So they
like it defies all, aside from
cannot for the life of me understand. Like, it was they have this weird thing where they're talking about going in. They're like, yeah, we're gonna kill hostages when we go in. And I don't know if they thought that they were gonna kill them but it's just like an assumed thing, like hostages are gonna die, we go in. And they're the ones
who killed the hostages.
Yeah, no, there's out of the 43 deaths that happened at Attica, four of those victims are killed by the prisoners. Three of those are prisoners that were killed, like, I think before the riot. Mm. And then one of them is that Officer Quinn guy who's killed at the beginning of the riot. The other 29 inmates and 10 hostages that were killed by the New York State Police, who just came in firing and spraying everything. People were carrying Thompson submachine guns. People, deputies and like COs had their own personal weapons. People were firing 357 Magnums. And it didn't stop when the few people were on the ground. They just kept shooting. Like, there's various eyewitness testimony of people, like, well, not eyewitness testimony, because nobody ever, these people didn't, they didn't prosecute the state police. But like, of people just being like, yeah, they came in shooting and people on the ground, and they got shot more. People had their hands up. That Sam Melville guy who from the Weather Underground, I think he had done some bombing. They say he got shot with his hands up. L.D. Barkley, who was like an orator who had been like speaking a lot during the prison uprising. People say he got executed later, and that they dragged him somewhere and they shot him. You have a guy like Jomo, I'm blanking on his name right now. Let me go up and look at his name. Jomo Joko Amawale, who is a guy who was shot 6 to 7 times and did not receive medical treatment. They just left him for like a couple of days and then took him to the fucking hospital. So these guys are then they spray the whole fucking D yard, shoot everything that moves. Everything. And then after they do that, then they proceed to torture the inmates, tell them to strip and have them crawl across the bare ground of the yard, which is filled with glass and stuff. There's kind of talk about kind of for days and like weeks, kind of days. I think it's days. I don't know if it was weeks, but reprisals of inmates being forced to a cell, like packed in a cell or in a cell that was already slick with the blood of other people. Mock executions where people would come over to your cell, put a gun in the through the whatchamacallit, through the bars, and be like, to try to be like, oh, I'm gonna kill you. Like basically, and it was just fucked like up. Fucked up reprisal shit that they just did. It's on the wall, apparently on the wall in D Yard, the New York State Police and had put, you know, some after they retook the yard, 31 dead niggers. The whole time they're being assaulted, like physically, like for, you know, racially. This was something that was going on before with the COs. Like black people didn't get paid as much in the prison. I forgot to bring that up. But yeah, so it's just kind of this spree of like violence, of torture, and of this after the retaking, which was crazy enough. And then the torture and the reprisals that happened after. For days, or I'm blanking on however long. So immediately, and this is like something police departments always do, is they come out and they're like, look, successful job. They like, people were like, they're like, the state was like, you guys are heroes. Showed a lot of restraint out there. they're coming out. And then the one thing that always stuck out to me is they tried to say, hey, nine hostages got killed, and then one of them dies a little bit later from the wounds. All 10 of the hostages, I think two of them had nicks on their neck, from like one guy, I think one guy like nicked them, but like, I'm just trying to make it look real. And then another one, I think he got it while the shooting happened. He like nicked them because he's fucking because he fell from the bullets. I'm not too sure about that part. But like they had two of them had nicks on their neck, but the 10 hostages, everybody's like, they tried to say that the prisoner stabbed them to death. And there's like all of this force, this pressure on this, like this, you know, I forgot the guys who like look at the bodies, the guys who do the autopsies, to say that these are like stab wounds when they're like obviously gunshot wounds. Mm-hmm. Like, and they go through many, like a couple of guys who are like the guys who do the autopsy, to try to get them to like say, hey, these are stab wounds and not gunshot wounds.
Right.
Yeah.
You're seeing what I'm seeing, right? Yeah. And you're seeing a stab wound, not this circular hole with a little bit of residue next to it. That's actually from this new type of knife invented by the prisoners, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
They made it out of a spoon or some shit.
It's weird. It's like especially hard because they're fucking like, especially they had a lot of shotguns. They're spraying pellet shots up there. How the fuck? Like, I don't like it's like the kind of cover up of it, the lying about it that starts right after.
Yeah.
There's again, we don't have time to cover everything about this because then we have to get to all of the court cases. The state, of course, goes on a prosecution bit to make the prisoners and the leaders of the prison riot rebellion of the prison uprising, tries to make them like seem like sadists, when from all kind of accounts of the actual uprising, they just were like, yeah, we just want to keep them safe. We want to get these demands and, you know, get these prisons, make this prison a little bit better.
We just want better food and go outside and a reasonable doctor.
Yeah.
A doctor that isn't hungover. Yeah. And drunk all of the time. That's all we're
That's like literally what their ass were.
Jesus Christ, that's fucked up.
You get into the course the court cases. There's a brief overview. You have like the kind of Attica brother legal defense fund stuff. You have the Hill and Pernas Elise case, which is basically they convict these two youth, they like 22, 23. They were at the uprising. They convict them of killing William Quinn on like very shaky evidence, like kind of like bullshit, you know, basically bullshit evidence, at least from what I'm reading in Blood in the Water. you know, the Bolello case, which is not really associated with that, which is one of my favorite, which is like, there was this guy who was a part of the uprising, who was just like an Italian, like mafioso type guy, who fucking just was around, and like, he didn't want to even be a part of the like legal defense fund. And he just took his years to like, just took his like kidnapping charge and extra years. And then like, he is on the way to another prison, he gets stabbed by a guy named Donald Frankos, aka Donnie Frankos. Like, okay. So the reason why they're saying that he didn't want to be a part of it, because he was like, I am actually a mafioso and I can't be a part of it.
Yeah,
shit.
Yeah. Yeah,
the Shango case, you have the Jomo case, you know, later the state gives settlements. I think it was like around 12 million, I'm pretty sure. And then you have
he pays it out to the prisoners or their families?
To the prisoners and the families of the prisoners who were, you know, hurt in the retaking and then the torture that happened after.
The massacre.
But the massacre. Yeah. And the New York State has never admitted fault or guilt for it. Also the fallen victims of Attica, which is gonna be the other side of the thing, the hostages who were killed. Their families go on like this long spree of like, they don't believe that the state police did it for forever.
Fucking then, Christ. I'm sorry. It just defies
reason.
Like any sort of like, so the way I understand it or what's popping into my head is Nelson Rockefeller wanted to like feel like a big man. Because his fucking manhood felt challenged by these prisoners who were protesting these conditions.
Yeah.
And he's like, oh, you talk to me that way? And then he sends these goons in, these armed goons in there who kill 43 people. And then he has to pay. And then the state of New York has to pay out millions of dollars to the families of the deceased. What, even from like a strictly rational cost benefit analysis, removing all human considerations and ethics or anything like
which
that.
Which is a wild
what
point.
The fuck was cheaper?
That's like, a wild point. On, I'm man. Not gonna. I'm not even gonna fuck with that point.
You know what I'm saying?
I'm
like,
not gonna fuck with that point.
Ethics aside, I mean, ethics are an important part. But in the brain of Nelson Rockefeller,
he wanted
to prove you were such a big man and put this down as violently and as unnecessarily as possible when all you had to do was
remember, you have to talk about more of his political career. He was getting fucking outshined by Nixon took his whole vibe. He's like, he used to be in like, he was supposed to be like the next like that, I think, Republican kind of president.
I think there was a thing where he was wanting to be nominated in 68.
Yeah,
I don't know though.
And Nixon took his whole fucking shine on this law and order kick, and like, he's like, if that's the wave,
tricky
like being
dick,
a liberal,
man.
Yeah, being a liberal like guy is not gonna work. I'm a politician, so I'm Mr. Law and Order.
Yeah,
and this is how what I think of as law and order. There's a lot of evidence. I don't know if a lot of evidence, but like, particularly there's weird stuff like. The guy who actually handled the retaking is a relatively low officer in like the New York State Police. The head of the New York State Police, who should have been on site for like the one of the biggest prison riots in New York State history, he was on vacation and wasn't called back. Like, you know what I mean? Like, there's like a lot of the higher up officials all of a sudden just in New York State at the time just disappeared. Just got ghost out of nowhere.
I'm taking my vacation. I'm taking the kids to Hawaii. Okay, I'm gonna be out this week.
Attica, what Attica? Yeah.
Huh? What? I didn't hear about this.
Lastly, the fallen victims of Attica, which is the opposite side of kind of the Attica Brothers Legal Defense Fund. These are the collective of the families of the hostages. They get like a $12 million settlement. It's the hostages, anybody who was killed by killed or injured in the retaking and stuff like that. It's interesting, even like years later, like the fallen victims of Attica, there's like an assault that takes place in Attica where four guards get charged with a crime, like they get indicted on a like felonious crime cover up and stuff like that. It's like in the 2000s, I'm pretty sure. And they end up like the fallen victims of Attica, even after knowing all of this like stuff has happened with the police and the guards and stuff like that, still support the guards and like legal funds, like years later when they're accused of beating a prisoner. And you know, like that's a, you know, it's a weird story because you think these people should be united, but they're not exactly united. Some of the people in it like each other, like William Quinn's daughter and Big Black Smith, Frank Big Black Smith become friends. But like, these both probably poor working class peoples are pinned against each other on the opposite sides of this fence.
Yeah.
When in reality, you guys really should be linking up. But you know, that's a whole nother story for another day. The legacy of Attica. You might know Attica from, you know, the John Lennon song about Attica. There's a fucking you've seen Dog Day Afternoon, when he's robbing the bank and he's like, Attica, Attica. It's kind of becomes like a war cry for like a kind of, you know, more activist, like progressive liberal types during the 70s. But then it also becomes, there's a negative history where you didn't have to, like, we didn't have to go through all the stuff that actually happened. All the bad stuff that happened, all the stuff that the bad stuff that was rumored to have happened, that legacy and that like fear, the like lies around it had more of an impact in terms of like, it was seen, you know, the rumors about people, you know, the prisoners stabbing people or the cutting off genitals and stuff like that. And this uprising was seen in the, you know, the kind of the, now I'm trying to think in the, you know, in the most of the country, it was seen as this tale about how this liberal leftism had gone too far. It was even like the rumor, like the propaganda of it. You know what I mean? You know what I'm saying?
Of course.
Like, oh,
the CIA just went ahead and flushed that turd and it got picked up.
Yeah, like the prisoners, this is and this is
leftist,
like,
aggression.
Yeah, like this is the leftist aggression, which is not true. Like, this is the leftist aggression, and this is, and we've kind of been too soft on this, and we need to stomp this out more. And you know, you have people writing letters to the, you know, editors and stuff like that, being like, yeah, you did the right fucking thing.
There's a Trotsky quote that I've been thinking about. And I wanted to bring it up before, but now seems like a good time. I don't remember it exactly, but the gist is that whatever side is on the offensive always has great interest in appearing as though it's on the defensive.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then like more than that, what one thing that kind of came through this narrative, this story, this tragedy is the idea that like, of how law and order is used, if it's used as a byline to mean we will crush dissent and then maintain the status quo, where you are, it's like a return to the status quo after dissent is crushed. It's that you could have law and order through negotiating. It's in fact a more effective way, arguably, to maintain law and order is by addressing the grievances. But instead, whenever you hear the term law and order, it always means like, okay, something bad is going to happen and then nothing will get done. But it's like, okay, but how is it? This is not. There's a better way to do things. You know,
it's seen as part of the impetus of like, you know, it doesn't, the prison population doesn't get lesser after this. It explodes.
Yeah.
And it's kind of, you know, but that's the story of Attica, man. It's a tragedy, a massacre, would you say correctly? Uprising, a rebellion, all of that, you know, combined, in a tragic story. Guys, we want to thank you for listening to our episode on Attica. We want you to please come back. Please like, follow, share, subscribe, all our stuff. And also follow us at Hardfire History on Instagram and Facebook, and HFH Podcast on Twitter, Hardfire History on YouTube. Also follow me at Joshua B. Stokes on Instagram and Twitter, and Joshua Stokes on Facebook. Henry, where can they find you at?
I'm just Henry Price on IG and Henry Price on Facebook.
Okay, man. Thank you for listening. And we, you know, we hope you come back and we'll see you guys next time.
Next Wednesday. That's right.
All right. We'll see you next time. Peace.